One of the things that we talk about sometimes is the people, why do people want to become monks? And this is this is as many people as you have wanting to become monks is as many answers to that as you get. Or so they think. The Buddha said, if we are confronted with pain and suffering and stress, there are only two things that the human being does. One is live in confusion, and the other is search. Search for a way out. It's kind of fight and flight syndrome, if you think about it. To live, to search for the way out is fight, and to live in confusion is flight. Flight from the causes of people's stress. So the first, in Buddhism, the first noble truth is the noble truth of stress. And it's a very simple, very, very simple formula. And all religions, philosophies, theories about life, etc., have to confront this world and the way it is. And as we're born, we grow old, we get sick, and we drop dead. And everything in between is all kinds of filler to make us happy. In other words, they're escaping from unhappiness and going towards happiness. So the Buddha said the stress of in life and the fact that it ends in sickness and death, and the fact that we don't understand why we're here, the big question, why are we born? What is the meaning of life? What is the meaning of the universe? Etc. All the theological questions people ask. This is the birth of religions. So if someone has a certain way, it's a view. Someone who's going to be a monk has a view of life that people just don't have. We're weird. Monks, honestly. When I look back, as a child, I wasn't like the other children. It has to be someone who thinks a lot about what's going on. Has to be someone who is skeptical. Has to be someone who is not a believer. Not someone who is of faith. Someone the faithful never think about it. So it's a skeptical, leaning towards scientific method, leaning towards evidence, leaning towards experience. Do it my way. Try to test it to see if it works, especially when we're young. Ask a lot of questions. Be very annoying. And eventually abandoning all religions because they don't answer the question. They simply say, have faith. So that kind of person who is not satisfied with that is the first sort of basic for being a monk. The other is independence, someone who's very independent. They like being alone. Don't like crowds, not very social. Impatient very often. Someone who's impatient. But the big thing is this, what we call in Buddhism, we call it Dhamma Vijaya, which is investigation of phenomena. Someone who takes things apart, they want to know. And they're not satisfied with... I think I basically got rid of Santa Claus and Easter Bunny and Tooth Fairies and everything when I was like 4 years old. And my sister was still believing in those things at 8. My elder sister. And I remember taking her to the closet and showing her the Christmas presents and where they were hidden. 2 months before Christmas, my mother started stuffing things in the closet. And my sister just looked. She says, "How do you know they're not for somebody's birthday party?" It is interesting, and something that I've noticed, that there is a preponderance of Catholics and Jewish people becoming monks. Your guess is as good as mine. But this is true. Very few... for instance, I've never met an ex-Baptist monk. Never. Or evangelical. No. Catholics and Jewish people a lot. This is, of course, Western monks. We're not talking about native monks from Asia. So the cause... People want to become... Curiosity is often... The percentage of people becoming monks and staying monks is extremely small. Very small. Maybe one in 50 or less. They just don't stay. So in America, American monks, there's probably 20. And this is after a long time of having Buddhism in America, and many monks ordaining, Western monks and European monks ordaining in Asia. But in America we have 20. I think it's not even 20. We've had monks ordained, but they don't stay. So, someone decides to become a monk, there are impediments. And in the old books, of course, there were impediments for that are not really applicable now. Tattoo. The time of the Buddha, if you were tattooed, it was because you were a criminal. And nowadays, of course, it's the opposite. Well, no, it's not the opposite, but you can't tell by, unless they have gang tattoos all over them. You can't really tell by someone tattooed. So most people who are out of debt, they are not in debt either to the government for money or for other things. In fact, someone cannot have a case against them as far as a criminal case of any kind. They can't have debt of any kind. They have to have permission from their parents, even if they're 80 years old, and their parents are still alive. This is because when the Buddha's son was ordained as a novice, his father said that, you know, when you left, it was a horrible shock, and now you've taken my only grandchild. And this is very painful for parents. And then the Buddha made a rule that you have to ask the parents first. The ordination procedure itself goes back 2,555 years. And it was laid down by the Buddha himself, and the whole ceremony is done in the original language, Magadha or Pali language. And it's very precise, and everybody has to memorize this really foreign language and get it exactly right. And I'm good at languages, but it took me 10 days to memorize this not very long thing. And I'm sure I wasn't very good at it, but the Thais are very generous in our accents when we... because I was repeating a language that I'd never spoken before. But there's a precise ceremony for it. You have to have a certain number of monks. You have to be in what's called a sima, which is a marked area. Now, here we can ordain novices, but we can't ordain monks. If you ordain a monk, you have to visima, which means at four corners of the area where you are allowed ordination, they bury rock, these big spheres of granite or rock. And these are marked. Monks go from marker to marker, chant over them, and declare, this is in within these four is a sima. And the sima can't be broken even by electricity wires. So sometimes people are ordained in the middle of a lake on a boat. That's another way you can ordain, because that's called a natural sima. So if you're not on any land and you're floating and you're such a distance from shore, if lay people are present, they have to be back a certain amount of feet away from the monks for the ordination to go through. If someone comes running up with something, they break it. They have to start all over again. It's a very strict ceremony. This ceremony, it's important to keep the ceremony going. It's so important that when lines of monks have been broken in the past, they've taken, for instance, Thailand has taken monks from Sri Lanka, Sri Lanka from Thailand. Your country has a Siam Nikaya, right? The Siamese Nikaya in Sri Lanka is from Thai monks going to Thailand. The Mahanikaya in Thailand are from Sri Lankan monks going there. My particular sect is from Burma. About 120 years ago started. So they keep exchanging to keep monks' purity, the line, in other words, the line unbroken as far as ordination procedures and everything. There is this exchange back and forth. So if we talk about, now we talk about monks, we'll take the city monks first. Well, city monks, it's kind of monks who live in the towns, or villages it can be. So it's not city monk, but it's basically a temple where monks live in close association with lay people. Could be a village, a town, yeah. All monks.
So, but Theravada.
Theravada, yeah, yeah. Theravada is this kind of the southern school. Mahayana monks. I don't know how many there are. Tibetan also, because sometimes they're not monks; they're not fully ordained monks. So it's hard to say. And they don't always wear robes. We have to wear robes, but they could not. They don't have to wear robes sometimes. And then there are Zen monks who are basically have wife and kids and a job. And so I'm just talking about Theravada monks, and that. Now, if you go to ordain in a city, which I did in when I was first ordained, I went to in the middle of Bangkok. To a very large city temple. And most of them are pretty old. I mean, it's an antique. The temple was an antique. Everything was like 150, 200 years old. And you live in an antique room, and you eat off antique tables, and everything around you is antique and accumulated over many years, many hundreds of years. The monks, when I first went there, we wore a different color robe. We don't have any examples. Bright orange. You still see this in America and in Asia. Bright orange robe. It wasn't this color. So you can see yourself from it would be great for deer hunters to wear. It's almost luminous. I mean, frightens elephants and buffalo and kids and... You become a monk, and then they have a schedule for new monks, and that is you go morning and evening chanting, and you attend school. So it's very much like a Western setup, where the monks and novices, they attend Pali school and they attend regular school as well. They learn secular subjects, although they didn't used to, but they do now. And you have tests and you're graded and etc. The Pali grades go from 1 to 9 in your proficiency in the Pali language. Extremely difficult. It would be the same as learning Greek or Latin. So they get up in the morning, usually just about dawn, just when it's just light enough. A monk goes on alms round every day. Most monks do, except from the very senior ones, or they have some business to take care of. But in Buddhism, you can eat when you can see the lines in the palms of your hand in natural light. So you can't take a flashlight and say, okay, time to eat. So you see all these monks streaming out from the temples with their bowls. And they walk down the streets, not talking, not... sometimes three, four in a group, usually single. And you'll see people standing on the side of the sidewalks or in front of their shops, or they'll set up a table, small table like this, and there'll be a bowl of rice, and then there'll be a tray of things wrapped in a banana leaf or a plastic bag. And when you see somebody standing, you walk up to them, you face them, you don't look at them. And you take the lid off your bowl, and they'll put whatever they want into your bowl. Close the lid, and you walk on. You never talk to them. You don't look at them. And you do that until you have enough food in your bowl to go back to the temple. Go back to the temple. You empty out the bowl. You separate the stuff out. Usually, there might be something that is a morning meal. So monks cannot eat after 12 o'clock. But in city temples or the temples associated closely with lay people or other students, they eat twice a day. That is, they'll eat in the morning as soon as they get back, say 7 to 7:30. They'll have some kind of breakfast. 8 o'clock, the bell rings. This big gong is sounded. Everybody goes to the temple for chanting. There's a senior monk in charge of chanting who has a roster. He'll call your name. Then chanting is done. Everybody goes back, and they go to school. So chanting is usually done 8:30 to 8:45. 9 to 11 is school. So all the young monks and the novices go off to school. 11 o'clock. There's a drum. Bell always means chanting. Drum always means the food offering. 11 o'clock, there's a big drum in the center of the temple that's beaten. And that's everybody eats their food, and then it's back to school. And it's back to school till I think about 5 or 6 in the evening. All the monks come back, and then 8 o'clock, in the evening, the gong is, the bell is rung again, chanting from 8 to about 9. And then everybody's free. And this goes on day after day. If you are not in school, if you have finished school, then you're usually given an administration job of some kind. Which means the temples are divided, the bigger temples are divided into sections. So there'll be a monk who's in charge of one section. There'll be, where I was, it was the green section, the yellow section, etc. Most of them are named by color. And then there's the starting from the abbot, who's the head of the temple. Then there's the assistant abbot. Then there's the secretary of the abbot. And then there's the keeper of the seal for documentation, etc. So there's an administration set up. There has to be in a big, huge temple like that, and it is bureaucratic. It's very bureaucratic. I had to get my each monk has like a passport. We call it a baisuti. It's a passport for it's proves it's an ID for a monk. Sorry, not a passport. And it says you were ordained. It's got your picture. It's got the abbot signs it, and your ordination masters, there are two of them, they sign it. It's stamped. And then you keep that for the rest of your life. When you move to another temple, they fill in another page that you have been here, and that monk signs it, etc. Monks are kept track of. For the first 5 years, you are under a teacher. You're not supposed to be wandering around loose. So most monks stay in a temple for their first 5 years. It doesn't have to be the same one, but 5 years under a teacher. So if you're not an administrator, one of the big duties in temples in Bangkok is ceremony. Lots of funerals, lots of birthdays, lots of if a Buddhist gets a new car, they'll bring it to the temple for the monk to make a blessing on it. They get a new house, anniversaries, when somebody gets ill. So there's a lot of ceremonies. Most common are funeral ceremonies. Actually, funeral and birth. That seems people seem to die and be born a little faster, but die is for a lot of people. It's a lot of funerals. So you have to learn this immense amount of chanting, and it has to be memorized. You can't read it. You're not allowed to read it. It has to be by memory. So when you see monks chanting, you'll never see them reading something. It's always they just close your eyes and you maybe got it memorized. That takes up a great deal of time. The temple I was at, you had to memorize the whole book. It's a book of about 200 pages within the first year. It's all Pali, no Thai or English or any other language. And it's every evening when you have chanting, there's the normal evening chanting, and at the end of it is tacked on a discourse by the Buddha. So you have to memorize those discourses. A lot of memorization going on. You have to memorize ceremonies. As someone said, it's very easy to be a monk. Well, it is if you don't know what you're doing. If you're totally independent, independently wealthy, and you have your own hut and your own island somewhere, and you hire servants and people to cook for you and put in your bowl, yeah, you could be independent. But if you are actually living with people and around people, then there's a lot of ceremonies, and they're all slightly different. So what do you do when someone's dead? What do you do when it's an anniversary of someone's death? What do you do when it's the 10th year of their death, or the 100th? What do you do when someone's born? What do you do when someone gets married? What is the chant? It's all of these different functions that monks do. And they've grown. Who knows how old the ceremonies are? These ceremonies are not talked about at the time of the Buddha. The Buddha said, gave us a long list. You cannot do palmistry. You cannot do astrology. You can't do tricks or card reading. You can't do any kind of magic stuff. You can't be an entertainment center for people. You can't do anything superstitious. So he said, and then the people said, well, look, we invite the monks to our house and we feed them and they give this chant, but we want them to leave something. We want them to do something. Because we're in a Brahmin culture where there's a lot of magic, lots of magic. So you have Brahmin ceremony. I mean, there's all kinds of things going on that look, they're impressive, they look magical. So the Buddha says, I allow you to give the five finger mark. What is the five finger mark? It's never explained. So Buddhist monks, what they do is we have a paste, white paste, you stick your fingers in it, mix it with water, stick your fingers in it, and you mark the wall. So you mark it with dots. So five fingers has become used, it can be three dots or five dots or how many dots. And that they do on cars and new houses and things like that. other ceremonies, all we're doing is chanting. And chanting is what we're doing is we're reciting the word of the Buddha. We're just saying, in a language that we understand but nobody else does, we're just saying, so it says, basically it will start out like, at one time the Buddha was dwelling at Sawati in the Jetta's Park, and at that time somebody came to visit him and they asked this question and this is what he said. It's really sort of ho-hum. But when you chant it and nobody knows what you're doing, it sounds magical. Well, that's great. It saves us a lot of... We're not doing magic. It's not magic. But always it has to be learned in the original language. And this is how it's been passed on. And if it hadn't been done, of course, we wouldn't have Buddhism. Because it was carefully memorized. And only in India do they do things like that. Very few other cultures have that... obsession about exactly remembering something exactly as it was said. The Brahmins have chants so old that they don't know what they're chanting. But they pass it on century after century. Sounds. It's just sounds. Nobody understands it anymore, even the Brahmins. But they can't be changed. They have a fire in India that has been going steadily, nonstop, never gone out for over 1,000 years. So luckily, they were very obsessed about this precision in passing something on. Because we know even at the time of the Buddha, this is what they did. The Buddha said, okay, groups of monks memorizing what he said. And then those groups of monks would pass it on to their disciples, etc. So in Bangkok, it's a lot of ceremonies. You almost every day, invitation, almost every day. The temples are usually very pretty, very, very beautiful with gardens and lots of lay people. People go in there because Bangkok. It's just cement and cars and pollution and noise. Millions and millions of people. You think New York is crowded. So they come to the temples. And you see people, they're sitting all over under the trees. There's the only trees in Bangkok. So there's trees and there's fountains and it's kept up really. And it's temples are surrounded with these great walls as high as the ceiling. That thick. They were built to withstand Portuguese cannon. And it's quiet inside. And there are animals. The only birds in Bangkok, there are birds in the temple. Literally, real live birds. So people go there and they watch the birds. There's almost always, very often, there's a klong, or a canal that's dug within the parameters, and it's a square with four square bridges over it. And in that, there are turtles and all kinds of varieties of fish. So you can sit and look at the turtles, feed them. People feed them bread and... huge fish. It's a type of catfish. I don't know what the English word is for it, but one of the very big ones. So the monks are very much there for two things. One is three things. One is for ceremonies, and that's a demand for people coming to the temple. Two, it's for teaching. Each monk will have a group of lay people that is their monk. In a temple, there's never one monk who's like, in the city anyway, there's never one monk who's in charge of things. The Buddha didn't set Buddhism up like that. So every monk has a group of people. It's as if you had a number of little, I don't know how you describe it, we don't have anything like it in the West. If you're the pastor of a church, you're the pastor of a church. You don't let anybody in the audience, anybody, just come up and give a talk. But in Thailand, in Buddhism, you have a temple. Every monk, no matter how young, will have a few people that will come at least once a week and listen to a Dhamma talk by that monk. The more senior the monk, the older they are, the more people they have. And they come anytime. There's no, once a week in Thailand, there's something called one prat, which is a the holy day, which is not really holy. Maybe call it a holiday. I don't know. So it's lunar. Depends on the cycle of the moon. And people will show up often on that day, but if it's during the week, they won't. So you can have any day of the week. There's no really particular. We don't have a Sunday, in other words. In a forest temple, you drive in, and there may or may not be a wall around it. If it's in an area that has been civilized, in other words, the farmers keep coming and coming and coming, the abbots will generally build, again, a wall about as high as this all around, and it may go for miles. Inside is green, full of animals of all kinds. Outside, it's dirt. It's all plowed, trees mostly cut down, nothing there. So it's this green square. You can see it from the air, though, the big green squares that are for jungle. They're an island in paddy fields. Some temples, they're still temples that are surrounded by jungle anyway, they don't have walls. There's no electricity. I'm talking about not all forest temples. Some forest temples do have electricity, etc. But the temples that I lived in when I was in Thailand, and that was several, none of them, no electricity. They don't want electricity. It's not that there isn't electricity available. They don't allow it. They don't allow running water. So everything is by lantern, old-fashioned kerosene lantern, and candle, if you're going to do any reading or anything at night. So you go in and you don't see anything. You're going into the temple, there's nothing. There's a jungle. You think, where is it? You might be in the middle of the temple. You're not going to see anything until you get to the sala, the main meeting hall, which will be on stilts, made of all of wood, big trees like that for pillars. And it's up on stilts about to the top of the windows, about that high off the ground. And then up above, there are no walls. It's just like a gazebo with the floor raised way up. Because underneath is the coolest part. It's where you store things, but it's also the coolest place to stay in the hot season. So if you have any kind of work to do, you get under the sala. The upper part of the sala is hot. So you come to this big flat area with a raised platform in the center, and it's lower on the outside. There's a Buddha image, could be big, little, any kind of Buddha image, and usually one in the center. And basically nothing else. There's nothing. There's no furniture. There's no rugs. No paintings, wall hangings, nothing. Totally bare, just bare. And as you go up the steps, you'll see a big pot with a ladle, water pot, and it's usually on a pedestal made of wood, a log, and it's clay, and it has a homemade wooden top. You take that out and you wash your feet. You always wash your feet before you go in and out of a hut. In the traditional. So it doesn't matter if you're going to the sala or you're going to your own hut or wherever you're going to visit, you wash your feet and then you go in, you go up steps. The huts themselves, you won't see any monks except one. And it might be a novice, it might be a young monk, and that's the guest monk. He's the only one you'll see. And if you want to see somebody, you have to wait and wait and wait and wait. We don't get visitors. Now, very different from the city temple. The only person that talks to visitors is the abbot, is the teacher. Nobody else talks. Everybody else just stays in their huts. The huts are spaced so that if you sneeze really loud or cough, you can't hear the next hut. Can't be heard. So when they start a hut, a new hut, they'll have the monk in the hut closest to it, they'll walk down the path and he'll cough. Nope, still hearing. And they walk a little ways. And he'll go, no, we can't hear him. What can we build here? So they're all connected by sand paths. And these paths, they're just swept through the forest. And every day, they're swept once a day, every single day. Every path is swept. And that's to keep seeds from growing. And the paths are sand, and they're about that wide. And they connect the different huts to the sala. So it's like a spider web almost. You get up in the morning half an hour before daylight. So it depends on the time of the year. Usually 5:30 in the morning, probably average about 5:30 in the morning. You take your bowl, you take your robes, and you go to the main sala. And everybody's sweeping. First person that gets there sweeps. Starts sweeping, dusting, sweeping. Then they set up mats like these, except that they're made of grass, reeds. Set up the mats, you set up your bowl, put your bowl out, and get your robes ready. And then all the monks are together and the abbot comes, then you go on alms round. The alms round may be an hour away, maybe a half hour away, maybe down a mountain, it may be straight across the plains, it may be cutting through the forest, it may be... you have to go barefoot. And one of the biggest things for Western monks, the most torture is, of course, is going to a temple that has a place that really hurts your feet. Because if you walk for a half hour there and a half hour back over gravel, if we had hair, it would stand on end. It's horrific. It's horrific. And you can't make a noise. You can't go, ow, 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 you know. You see new Westerners, you see their faces are bright red and they're covered, they're just sweating. And they're gritting their teeth. And you know. It takes a while. And your feet get real tough. And then you don't feel it anymore. But you have to go through this thing. Go to the village. Now the villages are not like Bangkok. They all line up in a row. And they all have their little wicker sticky rice holder. And the monks are all in a row, not separate. Straight rows. They open it up and they put one little thing of sticky rice in your bowl for each monk. You make a U-turn and you go back. The younger monks have to go faster because they have to get there before the abbot gets there and the senior monks because they have to set everything up. Get there, you take out what you remove. Everybody has their bowl here and there's a big tray and your bowl lid. Bowl lid is filled with water for washing the hand. We're not allowed to use forks and spoons. Always eat with your hands, as they did at the time of the Buddha. So you're not allowed a plate. So if you have one cup, which is aluminum, and that's yours. If you have a soup or a soupy dessert, or you have chocolate milk or milk, or you have a choice. You can only have one because it goes into your cup. There's no place to put it unless you pour it into your bowl, and then that makes a big mess. So you have to be sharp-eyed. This is where you become sharp-eyed. Oh, it looks like chocolate milk. That looks like, oh no, they've got that stuff. Oh, is it soup? There's soup. Anyway, you take what sticky rice you want, you leave it in the bowl, kind of pack it together, you leave it in the bowl, you have your tray. Then the young monks, the novices meanwhile, are taking, setting up these trays and kettles of different kinds of Thai food, or Lao food, mostly where I was. It's offered to the monks, and the young monks then go down the line. We're all sitting in a U-shaped, from the most senior monk down to the least senior. So here's the abbot. Well, the abbot and maybe the number two and maybe number three, they can kind of pick what they want. Nobody else can. Psh, whatever it is, you get it in your bowl. Because you're not there. You're not watching your bowl. So if you're real smart, you see something you really like, once in a while you can go up to say, hey, put some extra in my bowl. But the abbot's watching. He doesn't like that chit-chat. So you have to be real fast. Otherwise, you just... And it's on top, on top, on top, on top. So you get really spicy, and then you get sour, and then you get sweet, and then you get... All goes into the same... It's great. It really is... It actually sounds awful, but it really tastes good. So this goes along, and then we're all finished. You get dry things on the tray. In some temples. Most temples, they don't allow you... The tray is for the leftovers, not for keeping things. So if you're one cup of whatever it was you got, then there is... everybody just sits there. The abbot may give a little talk to the lay people. There's lay people sitting there in front. Now we're talking about villages. We're not talking about cities. These are village people. Traditional Thai outfits. They came to the temple barefoot. They were carrying on a pole, maybe, you know, the carrying poles. They're farmers, and they're all sitting there. So the monks give a chant, a blessing, and we eat using our fingers, and you have to be very careful not to drop something into the bowl again, not to make a noise. In Buddhism, it's called suru suru. Suru suru in Pali means to make a sucking sound, or japu japu, which means like making a smacking sound. You can't do those things. You have to be very quiet when you're eating. And you have to be quick. Try eating sticky rice quickly. So you're finished eating, and then you take your bowl and you dump it on the tray. Then you get up with your bowl stand, everything, and you go off down the sala and out into the bare area around the sala, which has mats. And you wash your bowl, and you dry it, etc. The stuff on the tray, which is dumped out, the villagers eat that. And they fight over it. Because it's actually the best food they've ever had. I mean, it's really... Most people in the village, it's sticky rice, dried fish, maybe a little bit of dried meat in season. It might be rat, it might be snake, frog, insects, like locusts. Grubs. They don't... Bats, you know, fruit bats around. They don't get... they don't get good food. And so... But these temples, because people are driving from the nearest cities, not just the villagers are there, but the city people are coming with these big kettles of, wow, meat, you know, and all this other stuff. So the villagers... and it may sound awful, but it isn't. It looks like fried rice is what it looks like. So they eat that, and then they pack it and take it home. So all the leftover food goes to the villagers. The villagers then stay, and they will say, my son is sick, or this person's sick. So the abbot also passes out medicine to the villagers. Because people give us medicine, and monks almost never take medicine. It's one of those, you know, it hurts your feet, keep walking. If you're not really sick, you don't take medicine. So you've got all this medicine, all that goes back to the villagers. Plus all kinds of utensils and blankets and pillows and pots and pans and all that stuff gets back into the village. So you wash your bowl and you go back to your hut and clean out your hut. Now the huts are hut. In Pali they're called kuti. In Thai they're called kuti as well. They can be built anywhere. It can be a platform with a roof and nothing else on bamboo stilts. Just a bamboo platform. Bamboo poles and a grass roof. Or it can be super luxury, which means it's made of wood. The whole thing's made of wood. It will be one room, generally about 10 feet by 10 feet, 8 feet by 8 feet. It will have doors on, and it will have a door in the front and a veranda, about as big as this bench here. and that will be roofed. It will have one door and have three windows, one window on each side. And it's just a plain room. There's nothing in it. Sometimes you'll find a cabinet, if somebody made a wooden cabinet, that you can put books in, if you've got any books. Generally, there's a very low table, like a Japanese table, for because there's no furniture, of course. You're sitting on the floor. But it's really Spartan. There's nothing there. And you're surrounded by jungle. But outside of your hut, from here to the wall, is bare. Because you keep it swept every day. You don't allow trees or plants to grow in that area because you can't see snakes, you can't see centipedes, you can't see all the things that want to bite, scratch, poke, and sting. They don't like to come across bare areas. They'll go around it. So, well, that's most of them. There's a few snakes that do like huts, because the huts are always full of lizards. And two kinds of lizards that just every hut has them. One that's quite a big one, and one is a little small one. And snakes like the lizards, so they come into the huts to chase them. The stilts of the hut are on a cement. It's made of cement. It's a square about that big with a little moat around it. And in the center is the post, and the little moat is filled with oil, engine oil. And that's because no ants, termites, or anything will crawl across that, so they don't go up the pillars of your hut. Eat it. You don't want some of the ants in there and some of the bugs, scorpions and things like that. So that prevents them. The stairs to the hut goes up, and then it has a space that between the actual hut and the stairs that far, so that, again, bugs can't get in. So it's an island cut off from insects, except 50% of Thai insects fly. But anyway, you got 50%, you know, even the termites, you know, in season, they come flying in all over the place. So there you are, and then you've got a walking path. I was lucky. I had a cave. I had my own cave, which is really nice, except that all the snakes like the cave more than my hut. But there's a walking path. You go out, there's a little teeny path that goes out, and then there's a walking path that you walk back and forth meditation. So a monk can sit on the veranda and meditate, and then get up, slowly get up, go down the walking path and do walking meditation. And you're hidden. I mean, you're in the middle of the jungle, and usually people can't see the walking path. It's off into the jungle again. So you're on your own until about 4 o'clock, 3:30 in the afternoon, tea time. Tea time. So you go, and there's some monk making tea and straining it through an old stocking, and or maybe oleong, which is Thai coffee, which is like tar, and it'll just I always had to water mine down. They always laughed at me, and then I stopped drinking coffee altogether. And there might be Thai tea, which is a very kind of funny orange colored tea, and there might be one of the allowables after 12. And you think, okay, if you're... these are things that you would not feed to an experimental animal. Pickled hog plums, pickled in human urine, roots and weird leaves and all kinds of... Some of them are medicinal. In fact, they're all medicinal. They have to be. They're so awful. And to make them better... You can have honey after 12. You can have cheese. You can have, which wasn't at the time of the Buddha, so there's no ruling on it. You can have sugar, brown sugar, white sugar, garlic, peppers. So you take all of that and you mash them together. Yep, there you go. Take advantage. You mash it all together, so you've got salt, we can have salt. So there's salt, honey, sugar, garlic, peppers. Smash it up till it's kind of a sticky paste. And then smear it on whatever awful leaf or root that you're going to eat. And it's awful. But you get used to it. And then after a year, you're going, wow, look, we've got the hog plums. Who peed in the keg this time to make this batch? Well, I always pick the little novices. Anybody over 20, we figure, is contaminated. So they always pick, make the little kids drink a lot of water. Pee. Urine is considered, of course, a medicine. And in India, you drink cow's urine. And monks drink their own urine. There's, in fact, in America, there's some website that talks about that. No, I never did that. I will not do that. Cow's urine, yeah, that's okay, but not human. So then there's medicines. There's borapet, which I don't know the English word for. It's a thorny, it's a vine with lots of thorns and stuff on it. It tastes bitter, really bitter, like quinine. And we have quinine. So if you get a fever, if you get malaria or fever, then you just go out and the novices pick the leaves and stuff and mash it up, boil it, and drink it. And it's perfectly good medicine. And borapet, you're supposed to eat that much a day. Well, it's too awful to eat, so unless you put the paste on it. There are lots of... So this is the tea time. And it's usually hot water and green tea. And maybe something else. Sometimes they'll eat just sugar. Palm sugar, which is made into a round cake. And it's just sugar. You're just chewing on... After that, everybody starts sweeping. The whole temple swept at the exact same time. Everybody has these long-handled brooms, which we make, made out of bamboo and bamboo twigs, and they're tied together. It looks like the old-fashioned witch's broom. And everybody sweeps around, and they come together to the main sala. Everybody goes up into the sala. You get coconuts cut in half. Coconut, the outside of the coconut, the husk, and it's polished. It looks like a piano top. The sala, the floor of the sala is usually made of teak wood. And it's rough. It doesn't... It's nice. It's charming. It's bohemian. But it's polished like a piano. It's beautiful, beautiful. We make our own wax. We get beeswax and melt it down. And the wax... You never find something bought, a can of something. Everything is made. And that's polished, and everybody finishes polishing. Then there's the water duty. And the water duty is you go to the well, and the monks, it's hand-drawn. And there's a team with a cart, and it's filled with jerry tins, which is filled with water. And then that cart is run, literally. You run from one water place to another. So all the toilets have to be filled, the tanks and the toilets. The bathing places, the foot washing places, they all have to be emptied. Even if there's water left, you have to throw it out. Because we don't want mosquitoes breeding in there. So all the water is emptied. And it's cleaned and it's fresh water. It's well water filtered. As they pour it into the jerry tins, there's a cloth filter that filters it. When that's all done, then everybody goes back. Everybody's off to their huts, take a bath, and then you've got the rest of the night till 5:30 the next morning. So that's probably, we're finished just before dark. So you have the whole night. And then you can hear a pin drop as far as human noises. But it's quite, in the forest is noisy. There's all kinds of animals and insects and birds and tweets and growls and rustles. And it's not quiet. You learn to tell by the sounds what's going on. Different times of the year we do different things. Rainy season, it's a monsoon season. All work stops. Monk, only job is to meditate. The only job is to solitude. When the rainy season stops, we go into the cold season. Cold season, the time it may be building new huts, repairing old huts. There's broom making. There's umbrella making, there's bowl stand making, there's robe making, there's accessory making, all kinds of bags and things that monks use. There's a lot of, all monks know how to sew, they know how to build, they know how to make medicines. They can sew by hand and by machine. We always get these old Singer pump machines. And some of them are antique. They're pretty neat machines. They work really well. There's always a building monk, master building monk, master sewing monk, master handicraft monk. There's always one. And it's somebody who's gone up through the ranks. They've really worked hard. And when you're building a hut, it's really hard work. So you're saying you have logs this big that are sewn by hand. There's no machinery. So it's two monks, for all day sewing these things. Making our own boards all by hand, sewn sideways like this. So you get, if you're making a sala, you have a tree as long as this building, and you're cutting it board after board. So this takes days. It takes days. There's no rush. Nobody's in a rush. And if somebody's tired, you just stop. They don't care. Say, I don't want to build today. My back hurts. My head hurts. Fine, don't build. It isn't mandatory. Nothing is mandatory except going on alms round. Otherwise, you don't eat. If you don't go on alms round to the village, you don't eat. Sweeping is mandatory. Tea is not. You don't want to be social. You don't have to go to the tea time. Fine, don't go. So you can go if you want. You can go on alms round, eat, and go back. And only do sweeping and not see anybody the rest of the time. I'm sure I left a whole bunch of stuff out. Let's go with any questions. Everybody's in shock.
Well, what would you do with the dragon? Would you send it to the forest?
Oh, yeah, the worst place I could think of. That's what I did to John. He lived on an overhang, a rock overhang, with snakes and a horrible place. And couldn't eat the food, and he didn't like the alms round. It was down especially in the rainy season. You go down a mountain. This is a long, 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 and they still have leopards in that area. At least they did when I was there. I sent him to a tough temple. Yeah. He didn't make it. Hey, they can't make that? Don't be a monk.
What would you do now?
Huh?
What would you do with the new group?
Same place. Worst place. Send her to the worst place. It's a boot camp. Can't take the heat, get out of the kitchen. People think monks are going around meditating and levitating, and it is tough. It's tough. The first year or two, most Americans, they leave. Westerners can't take it. They think they like solitude. They don't. Nobody knows what solitude is. You stick yourself in a jungle with everything that wants to eat you and you'll find out what solitude is. They don't know. Being alone with your own mind. You try that. Nobody here is alone with their own mind. Good grief. I think I'll go into my room and be alone for a while. There's always a safety net. Oh, I can always call mom and dad. I can always call my brother and sister. I can always call my friend. Or maybe my wife will make brownies for me. We're never mentally alone. Even though we'll put our body in a room alone. Or we'll go out for a walk. Tigers and elephants going to crush you. So the challenge, you're challenged. I am alone here. I do not have relatives. I've got the other monks, and they'll take care of you. But they're not going to coddle you. No, the monks don't like coddling. So they went through it. The teacher went through it much worse than each generation gets it easier and easier and easier. But it's to make you... When I started the talk, what did I talk about? The First Noble Truth. What is the First Noble Truth? It's stress, pain, suffering, etc. If you run away from that, how are you going to ever understand it? Oh, the only suffering you see is behind, if you look over your shoulder, as you're running. So they put monks in those situations, and sometimes monks go on fast, they don't eat food for a week. Sometimes they'll sit for a week and not lie down. I mean, these are personal choices, but you can see monks pushing themselves. This isn't, I can push myself to do more than just that. And what they're pushing, they're not pushing the body really, they're pushing the mind's concern for the body. This is me, this I am. No, it's not. Born, grows old, falls apart, and dies. And I defy anybody to tell it to do otherwise. It's got to pay any attention to you whatsoever. Don't get sick, body. You're my body, so don't get sick. Don't grow old. Don't die. Don't have pains. Don't pay attention to you. It just does its thing. It goes on its way. It falls apart and dies. So we say, okay, I'm in this vehicle. This is my car, and I've got the ownership of it, but it's not mine. It falls apart, gets old, falls apart, etc. But if we associate and we cling and crave to body, then we do all the suffering that body has is mental suffering. So you're in a place where you say, okay, this is difficult for body, but my mind is learning things. But in a direct correlation, how we look, how we view body and the wisdom that we develop is a direct correlation. They're not separate. You can't take body and mind and pull them apart. They're stuck together. But you can say to mind, you know, don't do this. When training, you can. Never. Do not be angry. Do not be afraid. Do not be stressed. Do not... Yeah, train your mind to do that. And the mind will eventually come around and you get control over it. And it says, okay, these things just ping off me. Whereas before I got sick, I was afraid, oh, geez, weep, weep, you know, I might die in the forest, in the middle of the jungle, and a lot of whining. It's now, okay, so what body does, get sick, you know, take the medicine, get better, don't get better, don't get better. I don't worry about it. That gives you an enormous amount of confidence and self-reliance and happiness. To be rid of this and dragging it around like an albatross with concern. I should look like this. I should look like that. You know, what are my peers dressing as this? What's the new fashion? What'll I? Oh boy, how can people stand it? Should I get Botox? And I have a new nose. What is that? That's stress. That's so much stress. It's just a body. You're all ugly.
Are you recording this?
Yeah, I am, but I'm not going to put it on the website. So that's the. I'd like to put Marines out there. I'd like to see somebody going through Marine training and stick them for a year in a Thai temple in the upcountry. Let's see how long they stay. Hoo yeah! I'd like to see that. Jeez. So that's why people don't become monks. You go through this filter, 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 and it's the ones that remain are they're tough. Anybody who knows Ajahn Nuntakun knows tough. That monk is tough. My teacher is. There was a pillar falling, and he caught it, and he cracked his back. They put screws and a metal plate in, but the screws were touching a nerve. He has had constant horrible pain for the last, I don't know, at least 20 years. They can't fix it now. Happy as can be. Laughs about it, you know. John 1, dying of cancer, says, just leave me alone. Leave me alone. Why are you always... Think of it, we're dying of cancer. It was stomach cancer. That's painful. That's not painful. Wouldn't take any drug of any kind. He was like 75 years old, almost 80. Just smoked his big cigars, cheroots. Laughed all the time. He was always laughing. And he died on his mat, curled up, you know, with his hat on. It was the cold season. And never complained, never, you know. So you see these guys, and they're really, they're in the face of cancer. Oh, the big C. I know everybody here, everybody's panics. The big C. It wasn't a big C. It was a very small one to him. He was absolutely happy. He said, that's the way it goes. So you see that a lot, time and time again, where they just endure because it's not me. This is, can I do something about it? Then do it. If you can't do anything about it, okay, that's all right. Let it go. Instead of dragging it on, you know, going with all these tubes up here and IVs all over the place and some machinery keeping you going. Can't imagine that. So the toughness, a forest monk who's been a monk for 10 years is a tough monk. You're minimum 5 years under a teacher. And it doesn't matter if you like the teacher or not, although it helps. Different kinds of teachers. There's teachers that are tigers and there are teachers that are pandas and a few bunny rabbits. They're all good. But if your character doesn't fit them, so if a tiger type of disciple goes and lives with a bunny rabbit, he's not going to learn anything at all except bad habits. Because the teacher that is real kind, never raises their voice, lets everything, it's Nero fiddles as Rome burns. That's what it is. So then there are the tiger teachers that nothing gets past them. Absolutely nothing. It's as if they read every thought you had and they knew your minds. Nothing gets past them. And they're on it like that. It's a drill sergeant. It's a typical drill sergeant. And then there's the middle, in between. I like the drill sergeants. That's all. The only teachers I ever went to were the ones that were drill sergeants. Because I'm lazy. I'm lazy. If I had a bunny teacher, I'd get away with murder. I wouldn't pay. They even watch you. I think it was to Chris and Nathan and Matt. I read in the Visuddhimagga, it talks about characters. And how we have different characters, how we eat, how we walk, how our rooms look, how we talk, how we drink, how we sweep, how everything. And these teachers know by your walking what kind of character you are. That's the first thing. First they get you into this. Ah. Yeah. This one's going to need some beating. And a tiger teacher doesn't mean he'll always yell at you, because if he sees someone that is timid, he won't ever yell at them. In other words, it's counterproductive. If you yell at someone and they just panic, or what did I do? And they never, ever, just they're totally immune. And you see it all the time. But the rotten ones like me got yelled at all the time. And then all the monks, and you think, oh yeah. After a talk, the talk, a bell is rung in a forest temple in the middle of the night, it's usually like 12 o'clock, 1 in the morning, 2 in the morning, ding, 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 a meeting. The teacher always calls a meeting at the worst possible time. It's like when you just went to sleep. Or you're chasing a snake in your hut that you've got to go back to and no, now I don't know where he is. Anyway, you go to the meeting, everybody's lined up, the candles are lit, couple of lanterns, teacher's sitting there, staring off into space or chewing betel nut, paying no attention to the monks, you think. All the monks get in seniority, line up on their mats on this wooden floor. It's this thin little cloth mat. You line up very straight, and you all close your eyes and wait. He may not talk for a half hour. You just kind of peek, you know. But make sure he's not looking at you when you open your eye. Sometimes you peek, and he's like, and then he'll talk. And very often it starts out very slow and very quiet. You can almost not hear him. Just this real really quiet. So you're just like this. Then it'll get louder, a little louder, and then the fire will start to come. And he may point at a monk sitting there. You idiot! And just tear them apart for 10 minutes. What do you think you're doing? What are you thinking when you're sweeping? What are you thinking when you're sweeping? You sweep like you're drunk. There's no mindfulness. You're not doing this. You're going, what are you, walking through the park? Are you going shopping in a mall? What? Rah! And the monk, nobody makes a move. You just listen. So let's say this monk gets, torn apart. And then we all go down, scoot, 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 scoot. And we'll all say, how lucky you are. That monk was lucky. He got personal teaching from the teacher. Personally. We didn't. He's lucky. And we always pat the monk on the back who caused the trouble. Way to go! Because the best talks are when the teacher has something to correct. Otherwise, we're going to sit there 2 or 3 hours, and he might reminisce about the good old days as a novice for 3 hours, and you're on a hardwood floor and you can't move. You're dead from the waist down. So the teacher will say, okay, talk over, and you just kind of move your legs with your hands. Flop, flop. And everybody kind of, except for the older monks, they can sit for all day on the floor and nothing bothers them. But at first your legs fall asleep. And the mosquitoes, when it's mosquito season, you can't hit them. They're just, can't move, just sit there. He has a fly whisk. He's like up there, no mosquitoes on me. So everybody loves talks when you hear that bell ring. It's great, even though you have to go through this sitting still for so long. We didn't really have time to talk about the other. Tudong means wandering, and so in the end of the rainy season, the robe ceremonies are over, the robes are sewn, you've got your kit together. That means your umbrella, your bowl, your mosquito net, water strainer, and water container, some kind of thing to carry water in. Depends on what the monk wants to carry water in. And you wander. You go, leave the temple and you walk, and you do not take a ride from anyone, and you cut cross country. You don't follow the roads. And you just wander. And you get near a village in the middle of nowhere, and you kind of check it out, and you think, okay, I'll go on alms round there. You hang your umbrella. You have a circular mosquito net that goes over it. It goes down. You sleep. You put your bathing cloth down, sleep on that, maybe put some leaves around it and hope that snakes don't they can sometimes get into your mosquito net. The one thing about snakes getting into your mosquito net, they can't get out. They can get in, but when they try to get out, they go up the net. They're real dumb. So if you have something that will bite and maybe take your foot off or make you really sick, you have to be careful to let it out. They don't want to bite you. They're always trying to get away from you. The only time they bite is if you step on them accidentally or you're asleep when they get in and you roll on them. They can be in your mosquito net with you when you're asleep and crawl all over you and never bite. They don't bite. Only when you annoy them. So you get up in the morning, you take the mosquito net, you tie it up under the umbrella, you put on your robes and go out with robes and bowl, you go out to the village, you come back, and you eat whatever you got. Which is 50% of the time will be only sticky rice. So they just eat sticky rice. They're not fancy. They don't have. Once in a while, a villager will follow you back with frogs on a stick. That's always good. Or chopped up snake or something like that. Often it's something that you'd like some protein, but you can't eat it. We can't eat snakes. They don't know that. Snake is a common food. But monks can't eat snakes. We're not any kind of snake, any kind of dog, elephants, horses, people, of course. We can't eat people. And if we know they killed it for us, we can't eat it. So if you're wandering, and the people, there's no markets. Where do they get the chicken? Yeah, it's Miss Cluck that was under the house a second ago. So you have to say, you have to trick them. And say something like, wow, that's a nice chicken. Do you have a market? Where'd you get that? No, it's my chicken. I can't eat it. Can't eat it. So if you go a long time, Westerners generally... You know, Westerners, Western monks, you know, we carry vitamins with us, multiple vitamins. And half the time you end up passing those out. So, but food is very bad. And every night you're in a different place unless you find somebody that's really nice, like a cave with a stream next to it. And then you stay. You may stay until the next rainy season, just stay for months. If it's a really nice place. And caves are very, very hard to find. You hear about monks in caves, yeah. They're really hard to find. If you find a good cave, you're really lucky. Most of the caves are just kind of a hole in the ground, really. Or you may find a cliff is usually the more likely cliff that comes out. And if you're... There's always the thought that, what will eat me? So the only really things you think about are buffalo, tiger, and elephant. You don't worry about the other things. Bears are very uncommon. And if you surprise them, they'll jump on you. But they're small Himalayan bears, sun bears. But tiger, elephant's the worst, and kills most people, more people than any other one. The buffalo's second, because... If you surprise it, it just runs at you. Snakes, surprisingly, no. You get bit, you won't die. I mean, not feel good for a while, but you might lose a toe, or a finger. I knew little monks with fingers and toes. You know, the snake, it disintegrates the flesh. Scorpions, it's a big. I love the. Shows I'm going to kill somebody putting a scorpion in their sleeping bag. It's about like a hornet sting. Nothing. Spider bites, same. You don't really feel them until after they bit you, and then you get this sort of round circle that kind of dissolves your flesh a little bit. Doesn't go very far. That's easy. But nowadays in Thailand, of course, you can't find those things anymore. You want to find a tiger, you're going to have to look for one. And an elephant, there are all more elephants in Bangkok. Last time we went to Thailand, we saw elephants all over the place. They're in Bangkok, though. They weren't exactly taking buses, but they were people who can't work elephants anymore. They don't work, so they take them to Bangkok and they have tourists ride them or whatever. They're dangerous, too. Any questions?
Is there a particular teaching going on in the teaching monks in the forest?
You mean the teachers?
Yeah.
A lot of the teaching is just being just suffering, just your condition and how you view yourself and in relation to nature. And what they teach is mindfulness of breathing. That's the standard, you know, mindfulness of breathing. Investigation of body is very important. We cremate the villagers on a pile of wood, so you see them, and the monks are the ones that light it, and we have the sticks to keep the body from, you know, falling off. Either they fall off a lot, so we watch them burn and split and burst and. A lot of meditation on corpses, death, body, that's very strong in forest tradition. And the effect it has, is, of course, is to look at body for what body is, and also it makes you fearless. Strange side effect. Tiger? Where? Where? The monks aren't afraid in the middle of the forest. It's always struck me as strange. I never did it, but all the Thai monks ran around in the middle of the forest in the jungle at night without any kind of light at all. I always had my flashlight. So there it is. Ha ha, we know it's you because you've got the flashlight. They're running out of, you know, wherever they're going to go. They just don't have any lights. They don't use lights. And Thais are very afraid of ghosts. Not only tigers and things like that, but ghosts as well. No, the monks aren't afraid of ghosts. They sit there at night, you know, pushing dead bodies and embers at the bottom. The only time I saw a monk have an effect was, what was his name? Anyway, he's a really nice monk, and when the villagers bring the body, it's brought in kind of a box, but it's like a plywood, because it's just going to be burnt, they don't. But the monks always open it to look at the corpse before we burn it. And so we're all gathered downwind, or is it upwind? The opposite way the wind is blowing, anyway. They're all gathered there, and then another monk is coming late. And he's got 3 or 4 years of monk. He's not a new monk. So he says, okay, we're going to look at the body and, you know, investigation. Because there are 3 days, the funeral's 3 days. There's no preservative, and Thailand is 100 degrees. So it doesn't look quite like a human being anymore inside. It's gone beyond that. And so he goes to the other end where the wind is coming at him, and he opens it. And he goes, and he barely got his head like that, and you could see his face. He just turned green, and this got this look on his face, and went running, and he was like vomiting for 20 yards. You could hear him going, crashing into the jungle. And we laughed. Oh, we laughed. That was the funniest thing. We tried not to, but we couldn't. So, in Thailand, they take care of a corpse. It's not like here where we dress it up like a doll and paint it and make it smell good so it doesn't look... Oh, they always look better than they did when they were alive, literally. Thailand, no